fellow watch lovers, nerds, enthusiasts, or however you identify. You're listening to 40 and 20, the Watch Clicker podcast with your hosts, Andrew, and my good friend Everett. Here, we talk about watches, food, drinks, life, and other things we like. Everett, how are you?
Super duper. Really good. I am now, what's today, Wednesday? So Thursday, Friday, Sunday. I'm just a little over 4 days from Utah.
Ooh, that means we got to record again on Saturday.
We do need to record this weekend. Yeah, perhaps yeah. Sunday. Perhaps okay. Sunday. Sunday works. I don't leave till Monday morning. But we do, you're correct. We need to record again. I was at work today. So funny enough, I had a trial scheduled for tomorrow, probably a 2-day trial. And I also had a hearing scheduled for Friday afternoon. So that doesn't work. And I was, the 2-day trial has been on the precipice of settling. I may have said this on the show before, but like, it's like 95% of all cases settle and don't go to trial. And I would say in my line of work, it's higher than that. The 5% that don't settle are probably something like, I don't know, 90% family law, right? So like for civil litigations, we're talking about probably 99% of all cases settle. Non-domestic relations, civil litigation, almost everything settles. And so this case has been on the precipice of settlement for 4 months, but we're just weren't getting there. And we had significant settlement talks about 3 weeks ago. There's three parties. And I was like, okay, this is going to happen. Well, it's not happened. It has just not happened. So
taking it right down to the wire.
Monday. So today's Wednesday. Trial's supposed to start on Thursday. So Monday, I'm like sounding the alarm bells in the office. And I'm also like on these other two attorneys because they're dragging their feet. I'm like, what are we doing? Anyway, I'm like, okay, I've got this hearing on Friday and that's going. Friday's hearing is going no matter what. Like I can push this off. So I'm kind of trying to figure out like, what am I going to do here? I'm like actually in trouble. And you never think you're in trouble. These things happen sometimes. Something will get double booked and you're like, well, one of those is going to go away.
Yeah. It's hard for both of those things to go away.
One of those is going to go away. So yesterday we filed one of these other attorneys was like, I'm not ready for this. You know, I can't, I think we're going to settle, but I'm not ready to settle. And I'm not ready for the trial because I thought we were going to settle. And I'm like, hey,
well, be better.
Right. And I'm like, well, what? So anyway, they submit a motion to postpone yesterday afternoon, which is way too late.
Mm-hmm.
And like as of about 2 o'clock today, we still didn't know. So we're like, I'm getting ready for trial in the morning. At 2 o'clock, I get an email from the court on the Friday hearing, and it's, hey, sorry about this, but we need to postpone Friday's hearing. Please talk to the other party and get it back to us with dates. I'm like, all right, well, there's one problem gone. And then about 3 minutes later, I got an email that the order to postpone the other one had been granted. So
sounds like you got a long weekend.
And then I'm going to Utah tomorrow. So, yeah, all that to say, like, here I am prepping for a trial and a hearing, both of which are going to happen at the same time.
That's doable.
And my mind is in Alta. So I'm like physically here marking exhibits and my brain is halfway down a black diamond in 3 inches of powder.
the delays in all of that were just, they were too great.
I'm there, man. I'm there. So anyway, that's how I am, Andrew. I've been relieved of a massive amount of stress.
I arrived for a trial earlier this week and went into the DDA's office, who told me, oh, sorry, I'm actively writing a motion to postpone. I was like, we start in 10. She's like, yeah, I'm almost done. Sweet. You don't need me? Nah. Cool. I'll see ya.
Judge McAlpin, who is our presiding judge here, is he's got a sense of humor, but he's presiding judges are the ones that do trial call. So they're the ones that kick out. And he is incredibly tough.
Yes.
He's incredibly tough.
I don't
tough.
Like going in there.
And in, I told you, you know, so we've got trial in the morning at 2 o'clock or just after like 2:15, 2:30, we get his order and it says something to the effect of, I actually probably have a picture of it. No, I don't. But it says something to the effect of, counsel for scheduling purposes should be aware how close this order was or this motion was to being denied. It was very, comma, very close. And I like printed this thing up and walked it to the other attorneys in my office just because we were like dying. It's the funniest order I've ever read in my life.
Get your shit together.
It was very, very close.
I love like when little subtleties like that can also be the middle finger.
Yeah. 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 That's like that's right.
That was an admonishment.
Oh yeah. No, we're in trouble for it, sure. We're yeah. in trouble. Yeah.
With just a comma and a very 5 characters, 6 keystrokes, and somebody is having a stressful evening.
Yeah. We're in trouble. But it got postponed. It's going to settle.
You're not in trouble. You didn't file the motion.
I did file the motion.
Oh yeah. You did. Okay. So yeah, you're in trouble.
Yeah. I'm in trouble. I mean, he knows it's all of us, right? He knows that it's all of us, but
he's going to step on your toes next time he sees you.
You know, I'm not in court with him very often. And the
no, he's going to find you in the hall and he's going to walk by and he's going to step on your toes and give it a little twist, dude, to scuff your shoes.
The good news is he's a super nice guy. So, Andrew, I don't know if I asked you, how are you?
Oh, I am good. I've had a really busy few days. I've been like daytime traveling for work, like not working in town, which is exhausting. So today I was entirely in town, which was really nice. And I ended up leaving something that I was supposed to be doing because I had some support because I have some big things on my plate. So I came home, put my headphones on, and just worked. It was nice. And that's, chugging on along. It's nice to not have like actual stressful things happen. Like my new stress is like, I'm against a deadline.
Which
is like the normal baseline for what like spins people out. And I'm like,
I can handle this.
I can deal with this. In fact, today I like got to the point where I felt like I was going to be done working and I was like, well, this isn't done. It's not going to get done.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
That was liberating.
Yeah. I mean, for me, short of like, I've got to be in a courtroom tomorrow morning. There's almost nothing that can't wait.
Yeah.
And even I've got to be in a courtroom tomorrow morning can apparently wait.
Yeah. Until 2:30 the day prior when you're very, very close.
Yeah. So
I love shit like that.
But you know what, Andrew? We're not here to talk about civil procedure in the state of Oregon. Rather, we're here to talk about watches. And so we will. We're doing a bit of a roundup.
Unusual.
Unusual. And there was some fun stuff. Actually, when we started looking this week, I knew that there were a couple of things I wanted to talk about. But I was actually like, I started looking into the announcements this week, and I was like, this was kind of a banger.
Yeah, everything seemed really under the radar this week.
For like, a week in watches. This was a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, there was some good stuff. I'm going to start.
I know why you're starting. You're trying to swoop.
No, I'm not swooping. I am not Cheryling you.
Stupid.
Did you like it?
I did. I liked it.
I want to talk about a watch that I was kind of surprised by how much I liked. It is the Type A11 DD45 Dirty Dozen, according to Precedus.
I think that's right.
Presidus?
It's not presidious, because that's what I want to say when I see it, but it's not presidious.
No, there's not a second eye.
Yeah.
I think presidus. I think that eye is soft.
Oh.
I don't know why.
Okay.
Presidus? I feel like that would...
I think it's presidus, but it's somewhere in between those two.
It's not presidious.
It's not presidious. That's right.
We can agree on that. That would be adding a letter.
I'm going to say presidus. You can say presidus. And then we'll have our bases covered.
I saw a reel. I've seen the same reel a couple times over the last several months. And it's this Australian lady. And it's like some POV thing when you go down under and you say no. And you just chew on those vowels. And I was driving to Grand Ronde yesterday from Eugene, so it's like a 2-hour drive. And it just for some reason popped into my head.
It's one of the reservations in Oregon, by the way, the Grand Ronde Reservation.
It's a Grand Ronde, Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. We actually don't really...
We don't have a reservation?
We have one, maybe two true reservations, but the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde exist in a county a couple over from us. They have a casino there. So
it's like tribal territory, but maybe not a true reservation.
Yeah. It's not like reservations exist in the Midwest or in Montana, right? Or even in Washington. It's not, you know, a fucking state within the state. It's just like a little there's a casino. Anyway, I'm driving out there and it struck me. You chew on those vowels, gnar. It's like, oh, that's how they say no. Oh, I get this thing that I've like seen several times, and I'm like, I don't understand why this keeps popping up. Gnar. Oh, that's how they... Oh, funny. I don't know why that popped in my head.
It was an aside, but I liked it.
It was. It's like when if you say raise up lights, it actually sounds like how an Australian would say razor blades.
So precedus.
Anyhow, so the precedus... version of the A11. They're calling it the DD45. After having just talked about the too many or maybe not enough versions of this watch, I saw it and was immediately very excited. I'm going to go right into the specs. So we have a 38 millimeter case, 11.8 thick, domed sapphire on it. This, we know this. This is a small seconds version of the A11. The bracelet, though, is what really got me. It's got like a hollow, thin metal, like exactly what I want. Bullshit bracelet that you know is gonna be so good. So
this is a Bond clip, right?
It looks to be.
I think it's a Bond clip, yeah.
It looks to be. So when I and why I'm excited about it is entirely because of a whole other brand. So when Serica started dropping watches with these really super thin bracelets, I was like kind of concerned about them, and got the opportunity to put one on at Wind Up in New York last year. And was all in. Every concern was not just alleviated, but like, no, you're a fucking idiot for being concerned about this. This is phenomenal. As good as Serica's watches are, that bracelet construction, that design, the comfort of it is next level. And I think that this is going to be exactly the same thing.
I think it's the same bracelet. It might be slightly different, but I think it's the same.
No, they use a little bit more... like filled in. This is like almost,
it's almost like
tubes. Bars.
Yeah.
Like hollow bars. Close to a ladder, I'd say, but it's not that. Cause that's
not a ladder bracelet.
Yeah. Cause that's, no, but
I know what you're saying.
This is good. And this is a great interpretation of the design at the time, their kind of spin on it. They're using the Landeron L246UHR and calling it the ETA 2824-2 alternative. automatic.
Well, I think it is an alternative to. I think it's a it's like a 1-to-1
right.
repro of the.
But it's still not that, right? It's
the Landeron, yeah.
Yeah, it's the Landeron. 28.8, 25 joules, 40 hours of power reserve. This is good. They're calling the... Yeah, it is a bond clip. So it comes on a bond clip, a Perlon textile with pin buckle, or a brown leather. The bond clip is what you got to get this on. These are going to be available on Pi Day, March 14th, for those of you who don't know about mathematics. $875 on the straps or $925 on a bracelet. I've never gotten to be hands-on with a Procetus. Their watches are all of that ilk. They've always interested me. I like them. This is a really good release.
It's a cool release, yeah. It's a fun watch. I mean, obviously, it's an A11. It's a Dirty Dozen watch. And obviously, Procetus is not one of the companies that was
amongst
the Dirty Dozen. But they've done a really good job with this, and it's true to form, or at least aesthetically, it's true to form. I think they did a good job.
They have a super subtle sandpaper texture on the dial. That's like fine enough grit that it takes some looking at, because textured dials kind of, you ready for another one? They can rub me the wrong way. I'm on fire tonight. Oh no. I'll apologize in advance because these are going to keep coming. Super subtle texture dial, which in this application, I really like.
So I've got a watch by a company that I actually don't know a ton about. Youngins.
Yeah.
Youngins is, I think, perhaps most famously today known for its Max Bill, Bauhaus Max Bill watches, which are beautiful. And I keep meaning to pick one up and just don't. This is something about that watch, right? It's like, I kind of want this, but I also don't need it. And anyway,
it creates interesting overlap. And I get it. And I think there's a reason why.
Right. So Youngins is a, like 200 almost year old company, 150, 75 year old company, who at one point was the largest producer of clocks in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You learn something new every day.
I didn't know that actually until
they've just released the Youngins Meister Telemeter Edition JF. This is a throwback to a 1950s chronograph, a 1951 that had a combo telemeter tachymeter display. And so it may not surprise you that this watch has a tachymeter telemeter combo on the outside of the dial. This is a really lovely watch. It feels to me very Youngins with that big dial. But because you have so much going on here, the dial doesn't seem all-encompassing. It seems like it's perhaps less dial than it actually is. In fact, 99.99% of this watch's dial.
Yeah, but you've got two complications to eat some of the dial up.
That's right. So
it's like the Nighthawk. That's like all dial, but also all slide rule.
Right. That's right. So the story that we're given here is that the managing director of Youngins, a fellow named Hans Stein. Found this 1951 model, made one for himself, and within the Youngins staff, it was kind of a hit. So they've made 150 of these. This is a pretty beautiful, so it's a gold-toned watch, chronograph. You know, we don't see a lot of telemeters. I think we probably talk about them almost every time they come out because we think they're cool, or at least... Mm-hmm. I think they're cool, and I think you agree. But really, this isn't a complication we see a ton of. You know, a telemeter is sort of limited. This is like a wartime thing, which was meant to be able to tell how far away bombs or artillery were.
How far away the 88s were when they were shooting at you.
That's right, because light travels faster than sound, and a telemeter measures the distance based on the delta. Anyway, so you see the light, you start the telemeter, you hear the sound, you know how far away it is. So this has a, and in modern day, you can use that for lightning or you know, other things.
88s also still.
That make light. To the watch, though, because it's pretty cool, you ought to see a picture, because I can't really do this thing justice. It is a black dialed. It is a black dialed chronograph with a white strip that almost gives it the appearance of like a black bezeled watch. Mm-hmm. So you've got this black telemeter ring or black tachymeter ring, white telemeter ring, and then this black dial. Gold toned accents all the way around. Size on this is really good. So it's 41 millimeters ish, 40.8, 12.6 thick for an automatic chronograph. Yellow PVD, really sort of kind of conservative and short lugs. And for being a 12.8 millimeter watch, the profile is really thin. I just found this watch kind of captivating. There's only 150 of these being made, and I don't know it. I don't see that it's a limited edition. It does say it's limited to 150 pieces, but I don't know that it's truly limited. You know, I'm not sure they're holding themselves to that, I guess is my point.
Well, they also have other editions that aren't this gold DLC. There's a silver dial. There's a black dial. It's this PVD. Is it PVD or DLC?
It's PVD.
Okay. So this PVD version is the limited one. There's other editions that are not PVD'd.
Of this same watch?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. And the Youngins website, I think you get this thing translated, but it's a little hard to learn too much about this, I'll just say. Anyway, I think it's terrific. It's $2,500, which is, for an automatic chronograph, kind of in the range. It's an ETA movement with a Dubois de Prat chronograph module on it. I'm not exactly sure how this works, but whatever. It's how it is.
Yeah, it is the way.
It is the way. It's got these great sort of, I think they're like semi-ovular pushers, good big crown. This watch is just rad. I'm not going to say a whole lot more about it because there's not a lot to say.
So something that I'm looking at pictures of this, from the top down, it looks like this is a stepped lug.
Mm.
But when you look at profile photos, and in every colorway, so I've now looked at all of the available iterations, all the top down photos look to have a step. But in all the profile views, it looks like that step doesn't exist.
It comes right up to the case, to the top of the case, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like a shadow is being cast on the lugs from that top down. This is a really great case profile too.
It is. Yeah, it is. It's a beautiful watch.
And the curve of those lugs, they're like really steeply curved and mounted like mid watch to kind of suck down some of that thickness. This is good. The non-limited, the silver and black dials, I'm looking at them
now.
Can I see? Yeah, they're like $2,400.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, that silver is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really beautiful watch. Come up, picture.
The pictures on that website aren't great. Some of them don't.
And they like don't load.
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. Oh yeah, it's got like a bit of a dog bowl to it, which mm-hmm. is what gives it that really slender look from the side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is beautiful, man. It's a really cool watch. Not something that I was familiar with.
Me either. But definitely a cool watch.
What's up?
I like.
What's next, Mr. Ooh. Andrew?
Oh, I want to talk about a thing. British Watchmakers Day.
Mm.
The inaugural event is being held at Lindley Hall in Westminster, London. 40 confirmed exhibitioners this weekend on March the 9th. So if you happen to be in London in this Westminster weekend, this is going to be really cool. And it's, I think what's exciting about it to me, and I didn't do a whole lot of digging into it, but of the 40 confirmed exhibitioners, we have Arkin, we have Christopher Ward, Clements. I'm only going to talk about people who've been on the show. That's it. I thought
there was going to be a longer
list. No, there are many, many more, over 40. And I think when I saw this, I got excited because I remember one of the first times we talked to Mike France, one of his goals was to create this coalition of British watchmakers and really revitalize the British watchmaking industry. And I think this is a huge step. And this isn't all due to Mike France. Right. It's not as much ass and momentum as he can generate. This is a reflection on the revitalization of watch industries throughout the world. You know, we saw this huge decline in watchmaking during World War II. And then what was left was totally decimated by the quartz crisis. Mm. And then what was left was consolidated by enormous conglomerates afterward. You know, we had Hamilton surviving in the United States, and then they got swept up.
Yeah.
And in the last 20 years, we've seen this huge resurgence of independent, small brands making their mark on the industry, and not just in making their mark on the industry, and not just in the way of, oh, we're here, but design and development and research and truly being on the tip of the spear of innovation and pushing this industry forward. This is super exciting stuff. I'm really happy for it. You know, I don't know really how to equate it to things like, Intersect. Yeah. At Intersect or at, you know, Wind Up or at District Time or things of that ilk, these shows that bring people together around watches. I think this is maybe a little bit different themed, but it might not be, right? You know, we'll have to see the after report, but this is super cool. So British Watchmakers Day happening this Saturday. That's exciting. That's really cool.
It's pretty neat, yeah. And I think...
It's happening at Westminster. Isn't that where the king gets married?
At Westminster Abbey? I think that the population of Britain is something like 20% of the United States, and the landmass is obviously...
Like 8%.
Yeah, it's a much smaller landmass. So I think that, you know, in... What's the population of Texas, Andrew?
12 million-ish.
Hold on, I'm going to Google it. So the population of Texas is 30 million, I think.
Wow, that wasn't even close.
I think the population of Britain is about twice that. And so you get, you know, this is roughly like a, you know, California or Texas... On steroids, right?
The whole country exists within it, yeah.
Yeah, in terms of the land mass and the amount of people in the land mass. when you compare that to the United States, I mean, in the United States, we have, just an absolute plethora of nations, right? Mm-hmm. Which in the ecumenical sense, right? We've got these tribes, you know, the population in the Pacific Northwest is much different than the population in Louisiana, for instance, or New York, mm-hmm. or the Northeast, right? And so I think that, you know, it's harder for us to conceptualize something like this. Whereas in my mind, it would be really easy in another world to think of like the Texas Watchmakers Guild. You know, not that I think that there's a ton of watchmaking happening in Texas. But yeah, right. Like to the extent that was a hotbed of watchmaking, you could see it happening there in a way that it couldn't happen in the U.S. at large. So in some ways, I'm kind of jealous of that. Like their country is intimate in the way that the United States just probably couldn't be geographically or socially. It's cool.
This is exciting. And it's exciting to see this dream of British watchmakers coming to reality.
Yeah. Yeah, it's neat. And some really probably like, I mean, certainly you've got Germany, you've got...
Oh, Studio Underdog also involved.
Yep, that's another one. We got another one. You've got Germany, you've got, you know, there's some places in the world where watches are happening, but I think England, Britain is up there in terms of like the most dynamic sort of...
Yeah, and it's a true resurgence in the way that, you know, we're seeing in the United States.
Yeah.
An industry that was once really heralded was decimated and is back, baby.
It's back, baby. I've got a weird watch that I'd like to talk about.
Weird.
So, Isotope.
Oh, okay.
A few years ago, Isotope had a... dive watch. You know, Isotope makes these kind of funky. They released the Will Return dive watch, and the Will Return is a reference to those signs that folks hang in the door when they're stepping out for a minute. So, mom and pop brick and mortar shop, I'm gonna be gone for 15 minutes. They'll put a Will Return at 3 o'clock
out for lunch.
That's right. And it's got these, kind of bubbly hands with vague tips. So Isotope has a watch called Will Return, and they've just released this in a new colorway. And I just, in a way that the original did not do for me, this version of the Will Return is so charming. It's got like these really sort of classic... colors. I mean, you look at this thing.
It looks like the sign you would buy at Lowe's.
Yeah. And in fairness, the first one did too, but just for some reason less to me. So this is a red bezel, red hand, with a blue strap is what this comes on, like a blue tropic strap. And I just think it's terrific. It's got a fully loomed white dial with the Hydrium branding at the bottom, Isotope branding at 6 or at 12. These really like borderline comedically legible Arabic markers within like sort of a raised pad printed. This thing it's just so... cute.
Yes.
It's so freaking cute. FKM tropic style strap. And oh, guess what? 300 meters of water resistance. When you look at this watch, it does not occur to you, to me, I should say, that this could be a hyper serious 300 meter watch. It's got this very sort of like almost soda can tab. Seconds hand.
And size.
Yeah, I mean, this thing just looks like it's not a kid's watch. So this thing,
no, it's the size of a tuna can. It's 15 millimeters thick.
It's a pretty big watch. So it's a 40 millimeter watch, 48 millimeter lug to lug. Like you said, 15 millimeters thick. Although a full 2 millimeters of that is crystal.
But 13? That's a...
it's just... such a fun watch. But yeah, the proportions make it look like a kid's watch, but it's not. This thing's terrific. I really, really love it. Another lander on movement.
That's what gets me excited about this is the 350 millimeter version, the wall clock.
Yeah, that's
that
right.
That comes as its complement. Not a red bezel with the wall clock, a light blue bezel with the wall clock.
Right.
I like that.
Reminiscent of the original Will Return, yeah. So this is the red bezeled version, the aptly named Will Return Red, that comes with, if you'd like, a wall return, which is that colorway of that original. This is pretty terrific. What do you get? So for 840 pounds, Great British pounds, you can get just the watch. For another 145 pounds, you can get just the clock. Or if you'd like to get them both together, you can do so for 940 pounds. I think those prices are pretty close to dollar prices. I don't think there's a huge difference.
Yeah, these days we're about one for one.
Yeah, that's right.
So say $40 if you buy them both. I think I'm into the wall clock though.
The wall clock's pretty terrific. So let's see. The okay, so the Hydrium times Will Return Red and Wall Return is $1,222 for the combo dollars, and that's on pre-order. So the pre-order ends on, it says 3 days and 13 hours, which is what, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So you can pre-order these till Saturday for that price.
Isotope will also be at the British Watchmakers Day. They have not responded to our numerous requests for free products. So
what's next, Andrew?
Next up, we haven't asked them for free stuff. We don't ask people for that.
Oh. But if they do send free stuff, we say nice stuff about them.
Yeah, we do that.
And pass it off as if it's a genuine recommendation. That's what we do.
Yeah. Latest Christopher Ward C65 Dune GMT. This Jorg Weplink is calling this the brilliant first version of the the follow up to the brilliant first version of the Traveler's Watch, and I think I gotta agree. So the new 65 Dune GMT, 150 meters of water resistance, 38 millimeter case, 11.9 thick. Dope for a GMT, 43.7 lug to lug. This is money. And somehow Christopher Ward in that small package has found a way to like create this depth in the dial that is, I know it's an illusion, but it's beautiful. This, the top down on this looks like you're looking deep into the watch. Like it should be a 15, 16 millimeter watch with, you know, 5 millimeters of space between the crystal and the hands. Even the depth is,
I don't actually even know how much of an illusion it is.
I don't know how they're doing it.
We've talked about Christopher Ward's watch Spanx, the light catcher case. Essentially what Christopher Ward does is they move the movement lower to the case, lower relative to the case, as compared relative to other watches. So
but we're working in a 12 millimeter space here. So sure. So how are you going to capture any more than maybe 2 millimeters?
Well, so, and they do that with, like I said, they seat that case, that they seat that movement really low in the case, which allows them to build up. So, you know, one of the things that I've found with Christopher Ward's is you get, and especially a watch like this, you've got a relatively high stack. And so they have this dial that sits lower in the case than many similar watches, and they build up there. So they got this huge stack. They've got, their hands are spaced really far apart, you know, or really high relative to the dial. And then they've used these huge dimensional markers and a chapter ring that tilts up instead of, you know, Rolex has these big gaping rehots. Christopher Ward doesn't do this, but they bring everything up just incrementally. And so you get that. It's not an illusion. It's physical depth of dial. It's really, I can't think of another brand that does this as well as Christopher Ward.
Nobody is doing this as well as Christopher Ward. And it's gorgeous. It's also coming in at 1,500 pounds or under. On a bracelet, 1,465, leather, 1,265, and on canvas, 1,250. If you're pinching pennies to not get a bracelet on this, don't buy this watch at all.
Yeah, no, you need the bracelet.
This is gorgeous. It's coming in this beautiful sandy color with a green chapter ring. I'm not even going to call that fotina on the markers because it's not.
It's fotina. It's fotina, but not
in the way to make it look vintage. They're using that color intentionally to create that dune, sandy texture and feel to this. This is a knock it out of the park, Christopher Ward sorcery.
You know, I think another thing that Christopher Ward does really well is their handsets. They're not the only company that does this, but Christopher Ward tends to use these like gradually curving handsets with this flat, almost concave loom. And I think that also adds to the dimensionality. This is just a really terrific watch. Nailed it out of the park. I mean, it's just a C65, right?
Yeah, but it's now with the 330, the Sellita 330 movement, the 330, and just, man, this is good. This is really good.
I dig it. I'm going to take it, Andrew.
Do it.
I'm swooping. So the Alaska Project, a watch that I'm fond of, one of the prized Speedmaster references, is sort of like this. One of the things that's special about it is this white dial. It's just an absolutely bone stock, complete lack of pigment white dial. And that dial is one of the reasons that watch is so highly revered, because it's just like, there's nothing else like it. So Omega has released, new for 2024, is a catalog, non-limited, white dialed moon watch. And
it's just white, though. It's not like a big deal. It's just a white dialed Speedmaster, right?
Well, I mean, yes, it is just a white dialed Speedmaster. It's got a few tricks up its sleeve. So, Omega, I think perhaps more than any other company likes to play on its history. So there's a few things this watch is doing that are pretty special. So one, the white dial is meant, in this context, or at least ostensibly, is meant to be an homage to the white EVA suits used for spaceflight. It's also got the Speedmaster on this thing is written in red, which is a reference to the red striping on NASA EVA suits. That's pretty fun, but also an homage to the Alaska Project, because this is sort of an homage to the Alaska Project. It's got a dot over 90 on the bezel.
Oh.
If you want a rabbit hole, Google dot over 90. If you know what I'm talking about, if you know, you know. If you don't know, Google dot over 90. If you want to figure out how to spend too much money for something stupid. Yeah, come on.
It's a lacquered dial. How are you not even bothering to mention that
yet? Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes, fully lacquered dial, which I think is the first lacquer treatment that Omega's ever used on a Speedmaster dial. And I did read that somewhere. It occurs to me that it's almost impossible that that's true, but
I believe
it's true.
I'm not a Speedmaster
connoisseur like some are.
Yeah.
We'll find like a obscure reference, I'm sure, that they made 12 of. 13, you know, for luck. This is exactly as cool as we want it to be, right? This is a neat release with all the callbacks and some new shit going on, because this lacquered dial is clean.
So this is a 5-piece, a 3-link bracelet. It's a 42mm Speedmaster Pro with our twisted lugs, just like you'd expect. I mean, there's not a ton going on here. You've got a great stepped dial. You've got black markers. Really, what more to say? This is a cool watch.
50 meters of water resistance.
Yeah, it's a Speedy.
There's no water in space.
It's a Speedy.
$8,100 on the bracelet.
Yeah, sticker of $8,100, mm-hmm. which, I mean, that's how much Speedmasters are today. It's a
seller's market.
Yeah. So this was actually sort of teased by Daniel Craig late last year. And I think people have been speculating about what this was going to be. It's pretty cool that this is just going to be, hey, this is a new Speedmaster that you can get.
Yeah, I think it'll be a short-lived hype, because they'll release another one in 2.5 weeks.
Yeah, well, you know, Omega's learned something in the last couple of years, I think, about about releasing colors of the Speedmaster. So,
I mean, at least they haven't done a blue.
it's probably coming. Andrew, what's next?
Next up for me, I read an interesting opinion article by Buffy Acacia. Acacia? Yeah,
we'll go with Acacia.
Has watch size...
On time and tide.
Yeah, on time and tide. Has watch size awareness restricted brand creativity? And I read the article and largely it was like in summation, watch brands are scared to do things that people aren't going to like. Big shock. Neckbeards don't like things for whatever reason. Not shocking, because they have neckbeards. But I think what I drew from this article as I'm reading through it, I was like, there's like this, the access to information and to photographs and people like us who just like sit and talk about watches and opine for those who will listen. I don't think it's just watch size. It got me thinking about like CAD drawings and how quickly a brand can jam out a design. And I started thinking about Vero when we went up to their shop and they were like, oh yeah, this is our Tuesday prototype. And this dude just like plugs something into CAD, punches out a watch that afternoon, and is like, well, this is what I don't like. And I think I disagree with restricting creativity. I think it has honed creativity to a point that people are almost scared of being creative, because we can be so perfect. Because you can 3D print 150 prototypes before you send a prototype out to actually get put in metal. I mean, how many prototypes did you go through with the 11 Atmos? Not prototype actual creation, prototype drawings. How many versions did you draw? Not just by hand, but then into CAD and then into that ilk before you got to a point where you were willing to push the red button for production?
Well, yeah. I mean, there were obviously iterations and design work. I think we knew kind of the shape of things pretty early. But that's all relative. And then once you get engineering, that kind of changes. So I would say between that like first concept, which we've we've shared with the world, and production, we had one physical prototype, a sort of iteration prototype on top of that, the final version. So that's three. And then, you know, maybe like another two or three, like relatively substantial changes along the way. So eight, something like that.
What about the like 20 plus iterations of just drawings?
Oh, well, there frankly wasn't that many. I mean, it's hard to if we're changing the size of the hands in relation to one another, is that a separate iteration? I don't know. I mean, but you know, it took 18 months, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, there's a lot of changes that happened in that time, you know, but the actual case didn't really change that much. Mm. I would say the biggest change was in between the prototype and the actual production watch was the size of the crown. But outside of that, it didn't change that much. Yeah, I mean, lots of changes to the details, but not mm-hmm. that much to the case. I don't mean to be killing your point.
No, you're not killing my point. I think you're reinforcing my point.
Okay,
good. That like it was this endeavor to perfection to other people's standards, not just to your own.
Oh yeah, but that's a point.
Other people's standards that it took 18 months.
That's right. Yeah.
And that article kind of just like started churning the wheels on like, I love the creativity we're seeing in the watch industry right now. And I think of Studio Underdog, who he's obviously making something that he wants people to like.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's restricted by the, by that same desire to like, I need to sell watches. I need this to be a hit. I don't think he's independent of that perfectionist mentality. But I want to see more of that, like true creative, like we're going to do this cool thing. And because it's cool, people are going to like it. Not because it fits the size standards of what we want. Not because, you know, you look at 7 years ago, watches are sitting at like 45, 48 millimeter watches and have been steadily reducing. Mm-hmm. And we're going to bottom out and then they're going to grow again, right? This is a pendulum. And because of our access to information, our access to pictures and all of that, brands are trying to chase this trend by and large. And it's not a slight. Brands are conforming to what they see the market wanting.
Yeah.
I just want to see more Studio Underdog, where like, this is the thing that I really like. And I think Arkin's another really good example. Yeah, he's conforming to size, but his creativity, like he's making things that just don't exist elsewhere.
Yeah. And you know, one of the criticisms of Ken's first watch was like, so weird. You know, Andrew, and so first I'll just say, apologies if I take more credit than you're comfortable giving me. But when I conceived of this show in probably the first early parts of 2016, there were a few sort of goals that I had in terms of, and I say goals, that makes it sound like it was more structured than it was. But, you know, thinking about what would that show be, you know, the first was a concentration on affordable watches, because at the time it felt like the media around affordable watches was really limited.
But it didn't feel like it. It was objectively not there.
There you go. But the other thing was this focus on watches that were good. And by that, I mean, that fit like in a world that at the time felt kind of remote. You know, you'd go to Macy's or whatever and you'd say, oh, let me see that Bulova. And you put it on, it'd be like, it's like 43 millimeters. And you're like, fuck
this. And 200 grams.
That's right. And so, you know, and that is reflected in the name of our show, right? 40 and 20 was at the time that you and I together came up with that. It was like, oh, this is cool because this is what we're trying to do with the show. Mm-hmm. And it symbolized a thing that was, that existed in the world, but that was kind of like rare, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it just felt like it was hard to find at that time. It was hard to find affordable watches that were 40 and 20, right? Mm-hmm. But when we found them, it was like, oh, this is cool, right? And so not to say that watches have to be 40 and 20 to be cool, but like, those are the watches that we want to talk about. We're going to find these watches that are hard to find. Well, in the you know, roughly
intervening years,
8 years since this concept, you know, not that we've been recording for 8 years, but fuck,
we've been trying.
we're pretty close. We'll be at 6 years in just a few months here. Mm-hmm. In the roughly 8 years since that concept kind of was floated between us, that's become the norm, right? And that's what the writer here is talking about. Like, we're at this place where almost brands are like nervous mm-hmm. to stray outside of that, which is such a weird frame shift, right? Which is not to say that
we did it. No, it's we're responsible for it.
Not to say we had anything to do with it, but we were part of that group of people that were like, we want more of this. And, mm-hmm. and that's now become the prevailing trend.
One of my buddies this week asked me, he's like, look, I want to get a watch. Like, I love the sub. I want a sub. And objectively, I understand why I want a sub. It's a good investment. It's a iconic watch. It's got a good history to it.
All the things.
But I'm not gonna spend that kind of money on that. So what can I do under $1,000 that if a watch person sees me wearing it is gonna recognize it and know that I made a thoughtful purchase? And I was like, buddy.
And so when does his Christopher Ward get here?
This way, I was like, I'm not sure you're prepared for my answer.
And I'm a buckle in.
And I'm not sure I'm prepared to give you an answer right now. Anticipate my response in email form.
He's like, oh, fuck.
So he texted me the following day. He's like, you got any recommendations? And I had like 25 segmented out recommendations. Like, these are what you can get today, brand new in box. Mechanical or automatic, quartz, solar. These are the used watches that you can get, not brand new in box. Mechanical, automatic, quartz, solar. And then, like, these are the things, like I wanted to highlight a few of the things on the list. Like, these are the reasons that I recommend these specific watches. But the bottom line is, get what you want to wear. Because if you drop a grand and you don't want to wear it because you don't like it, because I recommended it to you, like, you're an asshole. Buy the thing you want. But going through that list, I poured over all of our episodes, because there's so much stuff that just kind of revolving doors. Like, it was hot for 6 months, for 3 months. It was hot because it came out, and then it lit. Like, Halios was on a lot of our lists. And we haven't talked about Halios in months, and it's because Halios just is slow to market.
Yeah.
And then when Halios hits, it hits. Because he's doing his thing. Orion, doing his thing. He wanted a diver. That was like,
getting a C60, right?
That's what I'm really pushing him towards. I'm like, get a used Trident.
Or a Manta Ocean King.
Yeah, right? get a used Ocean King. I'm trying to get him to push his budget up by like $300. Like, give me $1,300 and I'll give you the world. Give me $1,000 and you have a lot of choices.
You could have used Ocean King for $1,000.
Yeah, but you got to wait. And he's not exactly, wants to buy a watch.
So you can buy a C60 for $1,000 even today, right now.
On a strap.
Not on a bracelet?
Mm-mm.
How much is it on a bracelet?
It's like 12.
Oh, well.
And then you got to pay the $200 customs.
Okay, fine.
So now you're into it a little more. But that to say, it's still about what you want. It's still about what people want. And you're going to have people like me and Everett bitching about the size. Like, oh, I wish it was a millimeter smaller. And we do that. We fucking do that.
The 13's pretty thick.
We do that. We are guilty of it as every other outlet.
But we do it for you, okay?
And
for you. We're doing this for you.
I want brands to be like Studio Underdog and not give a fuck. I want them to be like Christopher Ward and not give a fuck. Because to do a watch that you can't read just because it's a Venturine, that's kind of baller.
Yeah, that's
like,
right.
Like, be more baller. A fucking minute repeater that doesn't tell the time, it sounds the time.
Andrew, we segued there, and it's okay. I loved it. That was a fantastic segue. I'm going through our list. Is there anything that we really need to get to?
That we must talk about? I just deleted two tabs.
We both had that Certina on here. It's whatever. Okay, so Powermatic.
It was interesting-ish.
Yeah, DS Action, GMT, Powermatic 80, Certina. It's fine.
There's what I really cool liked colors. About it was I liked the green.
The green's beautiful. It's too chunky. Listen.
Oh, it is. And it's not a...
It's 13.8 thick. It's a 200 meter watch. It's cool. 43
it's a sub GMT.
Yeah, it's fine. It's a pretty watch. Nomos has two new colorways. The red's really neat in the club campus. Nonstop red, endless blue, both for the summer grad collection. These are $1,500.
And red and blue are not the way I would describe either of these colors.
Yeah, the red's kind of brick.
It's orange and like tealy.
And the blue is a teal. These are very Nomos colors. Like if you didn't know better, you might see these and be like, oh yeah, those are club campuses. They just look like club.
That's new?
They're both available in the 36 and the 38.
It's like
half.
Zodiac announcing a new color.
I think we're good. I think we're good. Am I missing anything? Oh,
the new Seikos
62 Moss, better dimensions. It's a 62 Moss. We've got a better movement. We've got 100 meters of extra water resistance and slightly improved dimensions. This is an iterative 62 Moss release. We've got blue, black, and this like charcoal gray that's really pretty. Mm-hmm. They're $1,400. And they have 72 hours instead of 70 hours of power reserve. That makes it sound like...
It means you can take a long weekend and not worry about winding your watch.
We'll give these just one more second here. We're not in a hurry. We're on our time.
We are on our time.
These are actually really good.
Yeah, I agree.
Seiko did a good thing here. They've still got the same shitty clasp, but we've got a better movement. We've got 100 extra meters of water resistance. Like, this all of a sudden is, like, for under $1,500, like, maybe the best dive watch on earth.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
I mean, this is, like, a serious dive watch, and it's the...
I mean, it was before also, that's the thing with Seiko divers is that they're... Depending on who you talk to, each and every one could be objectively the best dive watch you can buy for the money. But you can also buy a Divex with a shroud for $127 if you're willing to get somebody to import it for you. And that's, you know.
James Stacy is pushing, calling these the 24 Moss. I think he had dubbed the last ones the 20 Moss. I don't know if that's a real thing or not. I'm happy if you'd like to use that. But yeah. The 62 Moss has been, the SPV has been iteratively improved, and it's a good improvement.
I don't like the integration of the N-Link into the case.
No, I think it's great. That is classic 62 Moss, and I think it's great.
I'm
here for it. It's a dimensionally milled N-Link, which is a very rare thing. Seiko does it really well. I'm cool with it.
If they feel like it.
Yeah. These are great, by the way. Oh, and the date, they moved the date from 3:00 to 4:30, which
Mike is going to throw a fit about that.
Mike can suck a dick, man. This is so good.
He's gonna throw a tantrum. He might be tantruming right now.
It's so good. So before...
It's going to keep him up at night.
Before, they had the date at 3. And at some point, Seiko added like a loom bit to the 3 o'clock date to make it comply with ISO. They've just tucked it in a circle.
I love 4:30 date windows.
At 4:30.
Because I hate like subdials and date windows cutting into movements. Like I prefer no date. That's kind of my jam because I don't like it, or not into movements, cutting into the tiles. I hate that. I'm all about no date. If you're gonna put a date on it, 4:30 is where I want it, or at the 6 o'clock, 4:30 or 6. Those are my two preferred date placements.
The charcoal on this is beautiful, but it's Fotina, so it sucks.
Fuck you.
So you got black and blue.
It's
Fotina. Yeah, it sucks. It doesn't suck. I don't hate it. It's also got gilt numerals.
Yeah. Which you would expect. It's Fotina, but it's gilt, so it kind of works.
All right. That's all I have to say about that.
Thanks, Forrest.
All right. Andrew. Other things. What do you got?
Oh, I have another thing. It's an interesting other thing. It's kind of.
But it's good because my other thing's not interesting.
Not at all. It's actually something that we've kind of talked about before. So, I don't know, a year, maybe 2 years ago, you talked about quarter sheets on the show. And I have some quarter sheets. I have some off-brand Silpats because I don't want to buy counterfeits. And they're holding
you
up
great.
You
have Silpats for your quarter sheets?
No. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Cool. I've only got half sheet Silpats. Half sheet is yay. Quarter sheet's yay.
Nope.
Half sheet.
Quarter sheet. Eighth sheet.
Okay.
Half sheets are big motherfuckers.
Full sheets are big motherfuckers.
They're way big motherfuckers. Like, you can't fit them in your oven. I think your
Silpats are half sheet, but
they might be. Either way, what I'm talking about today. Oh, actually, I am talking about half sheets.
Sorry.
I have half sheets for my. I have.
We're talking about if you're like, what the fuck are these guys talking about?
We're talking about aluminum cake pans. We're talking baking about sheets.
Baking pans, yeah.
Baking sheets, and they're aluminum. They cool off super quick, so you can like pull them out of the oven, set them on your counter for 90 seconds, then you can handle them. They patina really nicely.
They're cheap.
They're really cheap because they're commercial grade quality or kitchen stuff, mm-hmm. right? So they work until they don't, and then you throw them out because you don't care. Frank asked me a few months ago, he's like, what do you use for a cutting board? And I was like, you're not going to super like my answer. It's an all-white, like, piece of plastic. It's
that you get at the restaurant supply store.
You get it for, like, $9.
Yes. I use the same shit.
I know that you're going for an aesthetic, but I use, like, commercial-grade shit in my kitchen because that's where, not only is it cheap, but that's, like, where the cooking is done. Yeah. So you can do, like, you can do you, man. You can get your $500 butcher block. That's up to you. That's not where I'm at.
Yeah. Like, or get something that's going to work really well. That
is going to cost next to nothing. Yes. And then when you have to replace it, you have exactly no heartache because it's a disposable item. Awesome. Anyway, what I'm talking about today, eighth sheets. I was at the restaurant supply store. I was just kind of like perusing. I saw them and I was like, these are $2.50.
And just for context, so this is a aluminum baking pan, just like a half sheet, mm-hmm. same rim depth, but it's roughly the size of what? What would you say? A dinner plate?
It's probably 25% larger than a VHS case.
Yeah.
And I saw it and I was like, I think I could get some use out of a couple of those.
Mm-hmm. I use them for resting steaks.
These are my most used pans. Like, I'm going to buy more. I will eat dinner off of them.
Yep.
They're a perfect size for, because very rarely do you need a full sheet none of us need a full sheet. We don't have an oven to
support it. Yeah, the oven won't fit it. Yeah.
None of us need a full pan baking sheet going in. Very, very rarely. There's things that require it. You know, if you're going to do a bunch of stuff, it fits. These are getting so much use. Like, oh, I need to throw something into the oven. I don't need a quarter sheet worth of it, and which takes up space in my sink because nothing goes directly from use into the dishwasher or washing.
Never.
Takes up a ton of space in your sink. This takes up a dinner plate size amount in your sink. They cost $2.50. They patina just like the other aluminum baking sheets that you have. I'm slowly but surely replacing all of my baking sheets with these commercial grade dimensional baking sheets because they nest nicely together. They have the same lips, so they all press together really nicely. They take up less space. They're uniform. Doesn't matter where you buy them from. And it also doesn't matter where you buy them from because they're cheap. They come in 24 packs if you want, or you can buy them individually. The 24 packs, like $60. And yeah, dude, I love these. I'm going to start like phasing out plates for these in my house because they're dishwasher safe. You just drop them right in. Everything scrapes off because they're aluminum baking sheets. They clean up really nicely. If you want them to keep their shine, don't put them in the oven because they do patina and burn and crust. But the patina on them is beautiful. Yeah. So this is my other thing. $2.50 for eighth sheets.
I have probably four half sheets, three quarter sheets, and three eighth sheets. And they all fit in, I don't know, that thing's got to be
6 inches at like that amount. Maybe.
Yeah. I think the cupboard that we put these in is 8 inches just to the right. And they all fit in there. And they just fit. Like, you know, a lot of people like collect baking sheets and they'll have like 15 or five or whatever.
But none of them fit together.
They don't fit together. They don't nest. Like I threw away all of our baking sheets probably 4 years ago and switched to these maybe 3 years ago. And my wife the other day, this has been 6 months ago, was like, this is so much better. Why did we? And I was like, I'm telling you, man. This is the shit.
That's why kitchens use this.
Yeah.
If a professional kitchen is using it, you should also.
That's right. Yeah. Great pick,
Andrew. Love these. We went so far. A gift that we got for a family friend, like a group got for a family friend. They did like the Oprah version of our favorite things. So everyone contributed like their favorite things. And Sam and I were kind of like, Sam was kind of like, what do we do? And I was like, eighth sheets, man.
Yeah.
Get them four.
And you can use them as a plate too, right? In fact, like that's a sort of, if you've been to the Pacific Northwest recently, you've maybe ate off of one of these.
The photograph on the Kitchen Supply website that I'm going to provide in the links.
It's a sandwich and fries.
Is it used as a plate?
That's a great
idea. It reminds me of my childhood when my dad was super poor because he was divorced and paying child support and for two houses and the whole thing. We ate off paper plates with like the wicker basket underneath.
I love that.
That's what it reminds me of. I'm like, this is, I'm just going to start getting like, pull and serve paper to put on them. Cause my kids don't deserve plates. They're just animals.
Yeah, that's right. Kids don't need plates,
but they can have a eighth sheet with a piece of paper. Way less dishes. It keeps it clean, keeps it shiny.
That's a great other thing, Andrew.
Thank you.
Yeah. I've got another thing. It's maybe less universal.
It's right? Pretty specific.
It's pretty specific. The thing about eighth sheets is like everybody I know would love those.
Exactly. Nobody would not have a use for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So
you can't microwave them. Don't do that. Then that's the limitation.
So apologies in advance. Feel free to turn the show off right now. I'm about to talk about fountain pen ink. Fountain pen ink. Yeah, you know, whatever.
The color changes depending on the length of time in the paper. You okay. Aged ink. Oh my gosh, are you going to start signing really important documents with aged ink?
So,
that's baller.
I'm in a fountain pen place right now. I'm procuring fountain pens and I'm loving fountain pens and I'm using them. One of the fun things about fountain pens, it's like NATO straps, right? Like, oh, I can get this new ink. I got new ink.
Tens of thousands of options.
Yes. So most ink is pretty straightforward. Kind of like what you see is what you get. This is a beautiful blue. This is a beautiful green, whatever, right? This is the best black. It's ink, okay? It's the thing that you put in the pen to write with.
Yeah, like you buy pens based off of the color of ink that it will uniformly produce.
That's right. That's right. And so fountain pen ink
excrete.
Fountain pen ink is no different, right? By and large, you buy this ink, it's blue, it's whatever, this is really nice, it flows well, blah, blah, blah. You should get this ink because it works well. But what I found myself more interested in is inks that have like particular character. There's something about writing with a fountain pen that's special. Just in and of itself, this is special, right? It's fun to hold. It looks neat, but
you look super fancy.
It's fancy, right? But there's this like being given the option to put whatever you want at any given moment in these fountain pens to write with really opens up a world of possibilities. And so what I've found is that as I'm looking at ink, I'm not interested in, oh, that's a beautiful blue. I'm like, I want something that's got like some incredible character, right? Because like I can put anything in this pen. I can put.
Do you have to empty the reservoir before you?
Yeah. Not only do you need to
and then clean.
You've got to clean it. Yeah. Or else you're going to contaminate. Which is maybe not dangerous, right? But it doesn't make sense. Anyway, there is 8 zillion inks that you can buy. And that's actually really close to the actual number.
Have you gotten a red yet?
I do. I have a couple reds. Okay. I was just looking for a gray recently, and I ran across this line of Sailor inks. Sailor Pen is a Japanese company. They make pens, but in my mind, what they do better than maybe any other company on earth is inks. Sailor makes, they've got a bunch of different lines of inks. A lot of them are really, really special. I found this line. It's actually, they've released it in two different sets, and it's called, I don't speak Japanese, nor do I know Japanese pronunciations. I think it's called Yurameku.
I concur and I accept your pronunciation.
And it's been released in two different. So these are like lines. They do drops, which are a number of different colors. And these inks are all, I think the right word for them, Andrew, is vague.
Ooh, yes.
They're all vague. So what these inks share in common is they're all sort of soft hues. They lean towards earthy. We're not talking about jewel tones. They're earthy, but they're all, each of them is multichromatic, which is to say they have different colors depending on the amount of ink on the paper, depending on the paper you use.
Mm-hmm. The absorption of the paper.
Depending on the size of the nib you use. And they range from, you know, brown and green and purple and gray.
Vaguely.
But each of these inks has bits of multiples of those. So mm-hmm. I've gotten into two of these at this point. One of them is called Itazora, the Yurameku Itazora, which is this like
gray.
It's the ocean. It's sea foam.
Green purple. Yes. It's
beautiful.
The Urimeku Itazora is, it's fucking crazy, man. I love riding with it.
And if you look at the bottle, like if you were to buy this like nail polish, you would probably be disappointed because it is not at all like the way it presents on the bottle. None of these are the way they present on the bottle.
The other one that I've gotten into, and I've just ordered this, is called Suki, S-U-K-I, Gokoro, G-O-K-O-R-O. And this is, I think the best way to describe this is teal that turns brown. So here's a picture, Andrew. So, and a light shade.
Oh, so it's like as you're, oh, what?
On the lighter shade, it is this like minty gray teal.
Sagey, kind of, yeah.
And then as soon as it goes dark, it's brown. And so as you're riding, you imagine if you're riding with like a medium nib, it's going to lay down primarily brown, but with these like...
This is a purple glue stick. It goes down purple so you know where it hit, and then it changes entirely.
It's crazy. And when you write with these things, it's like nothing else you can write with. There's no... What's your favorite pen? The clicky...
The Pilot.
The Pilot or the V7 Zebra. Or whatever, right?
The G2.
That's right, the G2. There's no G2 on Earth that does anything like this. I mean, it's crazy. It's so much fun.
The only pens that do this are the ones that have the 8 little clickers on the top that actually change the stem that comes out.
It's really, really fun. Anyway, if you're into fountain pens or if you're into fountain pens, close. You already know. But maybe you like have a fountain pen and you're like, check out the Sailor Urimeku inks because there's a dozen of them, maybe 15 of these that have dropped. And for me, this is the hobby. This is the hobby. Buying fancy pens is nice, but this is the hobby, right? Because actually, once you write the thing, no one knows or cares what you wrote it with. What they care is what it looks like. And if you want to write someone a letter, say you want to write your wife a letter, how much cooler is it to write it with? I mean, because they're going to, oh, this is beautiful. And what?
Your penmanship is really the big impact there.
Sure, but even if you got shitty penmanship, at least your ink can look nice. Anyway, this was like a thing for me.
On like papyrus.
It just makes me want to do it. It's like, fuck yeah, this is cool. Anyway, Sailor Urimeku inks, check them out.
Most things make me want to do it. These are beautiful inks.
That's all I got. Andrew, here we are, an hour and 22 minutes in.
Shocker.
Once again... Anything else you want to add before we...
I'm out of things.
All right, folks. Hey, I want to thank you. All of you sitting in your cars. I want to thank you for joining us for this episode of 40 and 20 of the Watch Clicker podcast. Do me a favor and check us out on our website. That's watchclicker.com. We post every single episode of this podcast there if you'd like to listen to it. And we also post articles and reviews multiple times per week. If you want to check us out on social media, really, we're on Instagram at 40and20_watchclicker or at watchclicker. If you want to support us, and oh boy, we hope you do, the way you do that is you go to patreon.com/40and20 and you type in how much money you want to give us every month. Doesn't need to be a lot, but that is the money we need to keep this thing going. That pays for hosting and hardware and software. For all of you supporting us, but thank you so much. And don't forget to tune back in next Thursday for another hour of watches, food, drinks, life, and other things we like.
Bye-bye.